So tonight I'm going to be speaking to you about the topic of going for refuge, and as Ratnaguna rightly said actually, I'm very pleased to be speaking about this topic because it's one I care about very much, very, very, very much. But it's not one that I've cared about very much since I've been a Buddhist. It's had to grow. And one of the things I want to kind of draw out in this talk is that our Buddhist practice unfolds. If we put in the effort, our Buddhist practice unfolds, and certain things happen with that unfolding. And going for refuge is right at the heart of Buddhist practice. And it's right at the heart of our own movement, of the order of which I'm a member of. Sangharakshita, who is there on the shrine, who kind of started the order and the movement, wrote of going for refuge thus. He said, "It is the central and decisive, indeed, a definitive act of the Buddhist life." And he continues, "One does not go for refuge because one is a Buddhist, but one is a Buddhist because one goes for refuge." And I think those words just underline the importance of the topic which I'm going to be talking about tonight. So, one is a Buddhist because one goes for refuge. In other words, one's Buddhist life unfolds out of this going for refuge. And I am very, very grateful indeed to my teacher Sangharakshita for pointing out again and again and again and again the centrality of going for refuge in the Buddhist life. And over the years of practice I've gradually come to appreciate the meaning and the significance of going for refuge in the spiritual life, which I must say has been a very rewarding process indeed. So, and out of that rewarding process is a very deep gratitude to Sangharakshita for his clarity in putting going for refuge at the centre of Buddhist life. And it's really interesting when you read, he wrote a book called My History of Going for Refuge, and in that, something which I think I certainly took for granted, you know, the centrality of going for refuge, it took many years of exploration for him to come to the conclusion that going for refuge is at the heart of Buddhist practice. And it just underlined to me how much I can take for granted Sangharakshita as a really, you know, outstanding thinker and clarifier, if you like, of the principles of the Dharma. So I think the importance of going for refuge is also reflected where the going for refuge section is placed in the Sevenfold Puja. For me, going for refuge is at the heart of the puja. It's at the heart of the puja. It's around which everything else revolves. Before the going for refuge section, you're building up the spiritual mood which naturally takes you to going for refuge. So you've got worship, you know, developing faith and confidence in the Buddha. And that faith and confidence spills over in your desire to practice, which is what going for refuge is all about, as we'll see a little later. And the subsequent stages following going for refuge are kind of working out the implications of what happens when you go for refuge. You know, one naturally wants to, you know, kind of purify one's being. And there's that beautiful section right at the end of the puja, transference of merit and self-surrender, where you realise that you're not doing this just for yourself. You're doing it for the benefit of all. And I think this is a really, really important aspect of this term going for refuge, the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. So going for refuge is important. I think its importance is reflected where it's situated in the puja, the Sevenfold Puja, which is what you've been looking at. And the area of going for refuge, it's a huge topic. There's been a lot written about it because it's so important. But what I hope to do tonight's talk is to kind of pull out why I think it's important. And I'll be considering the following questions. What is meant by the term going for refuge? What are we going on about? Why is it of such fundamental importance to Buddhist practice? What does one go for refuge from? What does one go for refuge to? And why would anybody want to go for refuge anyway? What's the point? Why bother? Why not just keep life as it is? Surely that's the easiest option, isn't it? And how does one go for refuge? So these are the kind of questions, when I was thinking about this topic, which popped up into my mind, and I hope to address all of them in one way or another. So firstly, I would just want to look at the term quite briefly, going for refuge. And from there, I want to look at what motivates us to go for refuge. So the Pali term that going for refuge translates is sarana gamana. And we say saranga chami in the puja. So gamana is quite simple. It just means the fact or state of going, of a movement, a journey, a walk, or it means striving for the leading of pursuit. So there's some pretty weighty words in that bunch. So going for is a pretty accurate translation of this term gamana. But let's also remember that this also, it can also translate as a movement, a journey, a walk. So these terms for me, they illustrate there's a lot of activity in this going for. Sarana means a shelter, house, refuge or protection. So in going for refuge in the Buddhist sense, we're going for shelter, we're going for refuge or protection. And what are we finding shelter, protection, refuge in? Well, it's the Buddha and his teaching within the context of the Sangha. In other words, the three jewels. We're going for refuge in our own way to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. We seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for guidance in our lives. As I'll come on to you later, it's not about running away from, far from it. In fact, totally the opposite. We seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for guidance in our lives. The Buddha and Dharma and Sangha slowly become very important reference points of reference in our life. So if we have like a bereavement or an illness, we start to bring the Dharmic perspective upon that, and you know, the Dharmic perspective of things change, things are impermanent, and so forth. But when I say we seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, I'll try and flesh out a little later in the talk. So a question for me straight away is, well, what do we take refuge from? What do we seek protection from, shelter from? I think you all know the answer. I think most of you all know the answer to this question, but I'm going to go into it anyway because it's a very important area. Put simply, we take refuge from the inherent unsatisfactoriness, the painful, the insecure elements of life, the inherent insecurity in life. So we take refuge from those things. But there's also movement towards in going for refuge, in the movement towards the refuge provided by the Dharma on the basis of a deep attraction to it. Something in us is deeply attracted to the Buddha's teaching, and that is the kind of forward momentum of going for refuge. So there's a lot of kind of momentum involved in going for refuge. But let's first consider this question of satisfactoriness, because I think it's a very, very important thing to reflect upon. So we're going for refuge partly, well, I certainly am, because there's an inherent unsatisfactoriness in life that whatever I've tried hasn't managed to kind of take it away until I came across the Dharma. So the Pali word for unsatisfactoriness, I think we all know, is dukkha. And I'm sure you're very familiar with this term. But I think the traditional image which is given for dukkha is very, very useful. That the image being the ill-fitting chariot wheel. You know, we're out on the chariot, it's a beautiful summer's day. The birds are singing, the skies are blue. We're out on the road, freedom. But the ill-fitting chariot wheel, it's bumpy. You know, we realise, for example, that this glorious day out in the chariot has got to end. We realise that the person standing next to us on the chariot is not really somebody who we get on with and who we don't want to spend the day with, really. So despite the beauty around us and the sense of anticipation of this journey on the chariot, there's something not right. You know, there's something not quite right. And this image of the ill-fitting chariot wheel, we're going along and life is a bit bumpy, reflects that whatever we do sometimes, no matter how perfect this day, if we look, well, I certainly, if I look a bit closely, there's something not quite right. So we are motivated, or some of us, I must say some of us, and I'll come on to that in a minute, motivated to to turn towards alternative solutions, that, you know, to what's available to us, you know, the paths of marriage, career, and so forth. We're kind of motivated to look for solutions to this dukkha beyond the kind of normal channels. And for some of us, that includes investigating spiritual life, you know, the spiritual kind of answers to this problem of dukkha. And it's dukkha, of course, which can really motivate us. Some of us. And incidentally, coming back to this word refuge, when I say we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha from dukkha, when sometimes this word refuge, people say to me, well, that sounds a bit pathetic, really, doesn't it? It sounds a bit pathetic. You're running away, Mahasraddha. You're running away. And to be honest, they couldn't be further away from the truth. Because going for refuge to the Buddha and his teachings within the context of the Sangha certainly does not involve running away from dukkha. Not at all. Quite the opposite. So rather, going for refuge in the Buddhist tradition involves taking a kind of a persistent and sometimes hard look, a good hard look at our lives, and a good hard look at this experience of dukkha, if you have it, and examining this sense of dukkha in light of the Buddha's teachings. So, for example, my sister has recently been diagnosed with cancer, and the news was very painful, but it set up a tension. The reality of the impermanence of somebody that I love very dearly. My rational mind says, yes, of course, we're all going to die, including my beloved sister. But there's also a deep longing in my being. There's a deep longing saying, no, 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 no. I don't want this to happen. I don't want this to happen. And so there's a tension between these two things of accepting impermanence on a rational level, but not accepting it on a deeper emotional level. And I think this tension which is set up between this kind of rational knowing the truth of impermanence and the kind of irrational resistance to it is a very important tension, because within that tension one can reflect upon the Dharma very, very effectively, I think. And when asked what he taught, the Buddha replied simply, or quite early on when in his interactions with people, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Now that is quite a statement, isn't it? I teach suffering and the end of suffering. The Buddha is saying here that he understands the universal causes of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, and not only that, he's found a solution to it. Now, as I say, that is quite a staggering statement to make. But you see, I believe what he says. I believe that he did understand the cause of dukkha, and I believe that he found solutions to the problem of dukkha. And he found the solutions not by turning away from the facts of life, but looking at them unflinchingly, looking at them. And in a nutshell, the Buddha said that we suffer because we're in an argument with the universe which we're not going to win. We're not going to win. The Buddha spoke of what's called the topsy-turvies. So we want permanence. I do not want my sister to die. I don't want myself. I don't want to die. And deep down, I believe that things are permanent, and you know, it's quite a shock when these things kind of emerge in one's life. I don't want my teeth to decay because I don't want to go to the dentist and face the prospect of painful drilling. I don't want my body to lose fitness or health. I want when I use the car to start every time I turn the key. I want my bike every time I get on it to be free of punctures and the wheels go round when I pedal. And I make assumptions that all these things will be in place. I make assumptions that deep down permanency is the way the universe is. But the Buddha says, no, it's not the way things are. You know, please, please wake up. Look, look, look at life. Look at the evidence. Things are impermanent. Everything is impermanent. And the Buddha said, well, we want things to be substantial. But the Buddha said, I'm sorry, they're not substantial. When, you know, Mahasraddha, try and find the Mahasraddha-ness in you. You experience this kind of something of substance in Mahashraddha behind the name. But try and look Mahashraddha, try and look where that Mahashraddha, where is it? Is it in your head? Is it behind your eyes? Is it in your feet? Is it your toes? No. And yet I cling on to this substantial sense of Mahashraddha, and I do unskillful things on behalf of this substantial Mahashraddha. And the Buddha said that as long as we keep relating to the universe in ways which are opposite to the way it is, we will suffer. We will experience dukkha. And Buddhist practice then is aimed at eradicating suffering by dukkha, by encouraging us to align the way we think, the way we speak, the way we act, to how things actually are. Not how we want them to be, but how they actually are. And we achieve this by orientating our lives towards the Buddha, towards the Dharma and the Sangha. We kind of begin to understand dukkha by making commitment to the three jewels. So my first encounters with, I've been motivated by dukkha and attraction, and I just want to say a few words about that. I've been motivated in my going for refuge by a propulsion and an attraction. So my first encounter with dukkha really hit home, and some of you know the story anyway, when I was about 14 and I started helping my dad deliver his coal rounds in Dudley and the Black Country. Dudley. And West Bromwich and other places in the Black Country. And many of his customers were old, and many of them had suffered bereavement quite recently, you know, the husband or the wife or the child. And this really got me thinking. I thought, what is the point? What is the point of this, of life, if this is where you end up? And this story was repeated to me many times, many different times, by many different customers who we visited. How are you? Oh, I'm really sad. You know, I'm really sad. Okay, I'm really sad. And it just went, and this was a story which, as I say, was repeated. And it just really got me questioning. And I think that coal, I owe a lot to my dad being a coalman. And I owe a lot to wanting to earn some extra pocket money when I was 14 by hunking these bags of coal around, which were sometimes almost as big as me. But it wasn't just dukkha that motivated me to seek something different. I was pulled, you know, I was pulled towards the beauty which I eventually found in the Dharma. From a very young age, I was fascinated by the world around me. The beauty of a dewdrop clinging to the blade of a grass, just as it fell off. Light being refracted by that same dewdrop, just as it fell off the tip of a blade of grass. The grace, the beauty, the serenity of wild swans gliding across the surface of a still river on a balmy summer afternoon. The wonder and mystery of the night sky. You name it. Wherever I looked, there was this kind of sense of wonder and mystery. And I wanted to understand the beauty and mystery. I wanted some answers. It wasn't enough for me just to look at it. I wanted to understand. And I tried to address this kind of understanding through science. But I realized that although science can provide some really interesting and fascinating insights into how things actually are, through the biological and physical worlds in particular, it had little impact upon my experience of dukkha. The solutions, I realized, were to be found in my own mind, and that's where Buddhism comes in. The solutions are to be found in my own mind. So, in response to this, the propulsive force of dukkha, which for me started quite early, and a powerful attraction, I eventually ended up in Buddhism. And I eventually, when I was ordained into the Western Buddhist Order, took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for the rest of my life. But what does it mean to go for refuge to the Buddha, or to the Dharma for that matter, or for the Sangha? The Buddha is an enlightened human being And that's what I take refuge in. He's not a mere human being who's got some really interesting psychological solutions to make me a bit happier. He's not just an anarchist or who rebelled against the Brahminical society. He is, to me, he is definitely a person who gained enlightenment, and that is what I take refuge in. And like you and me, perhaps as a young man, he was deeply troubled by the frailty of human life, the inevitability of death. This troubled him, and he left home. He joined the tradition of wandering truth seekers, and after enduring many trials of body and mind, he eventually gained what we now call enlightenment. And I personally believe that the Buddha saw what he said he saw. I do believe that the Buddha experienced the nature of reality for himself. And I also believe that we too can experience that same experience, if that's what we wish to do. Well, it's not obviously as simple as that. I am personally quite fascinated and intrigued by the nature of reality as expounded by the Buddha. And at my best, I find great inspiration from the vision of existence the Buddha offers us. So the Buddha, as an enlightened human being, represents to me the potential inherent in all of us. Not just to change, not just to become a bit happier and smoke less fags or whatever, but to utterly transform consciousness. And I think you can get a glimpse of this kind of utter transformation, this turning about in the deepest center seat of consciousness, sometimes in meditation. You get a sense of some, the possibility of change in meditation as the mind just kind of lets go of these stultifying tendencies towards greed, hatred and delusion. And the Buddha said of his teachings that they had the one taste, and that was of, like the ocean, which has one taste of salt. His teachings have one taste, and that is of liberation. And I believe that's the case. And I find the example of the Buddha enormously impressive. His courage, I don't think I could do it. His determination to get to the bottom of dukkha, and his dedication to find the solutions. I go for refuge to the Buddha as an example of courage as well. The Buddha was a pioneer, and any pioneer, whether it's the first person up to Everest, the first person up to Everest is the one who we recognise for their achievements. We don't recognise the hundreds of people who now do it, because they are not pioneers. They are following well-trodden footsteps. The Buddha was a pioneer in terms of revealing to us the true nature of existence through his enlightened experiences. And this, any pioneer, requires a great deal of courage. The Buddha never gave up. I think I would have done, Siddhartha as he was before his enlightenment. I think I would have done. And there are some wonderful accounts in the Pali Canon of before his enlightenment of deliberately putting himself in situations of extreme fear and dread, going to the jungle in places which are in folklore traditionally inhabited by spirits which can just rip your flesh clean off your bones. Not just folklore, dangers from apparent folklore, but also the dangers of wild animals. But the Buddha, Siddhartha, put himself into very extreme situations of fear and dread, all for the sake of trying to understand the mind. So when I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in him in the sense that he's an inspired example of somebody who was a pioneer. And I do believe that the Buddha's account of reality is true, accurate and profound of how things really are. And we can take refuge in the Buddha in everyday life by reflecting upon his life. In a meeting, if somebody's giving you a hard time, well, how would the Buddha respond in this particular situation? How would the Buddha respond to this feeling of, not wanting my sister to die? What does the Dharma have to say about these kind of very challenging situations? How would the enlightened mind think, act and speak in situation X, in situation Y, in situation Z? And by calling to mind these kind of thoughts, we can slowly change, we can slowly become that which we look up to. And it's I think it's important that the connection for me with the Buddha is not just one from the sterile, distant cliffs of history. I'm not just looking at the Buddha as someone who lived 2,500 years ago. Over the years of practice, I do feel a very strong heart connection with the Buddha as well. And indeed, when I was ordained, I was ordained in what is a garden shed from B&Q, £29.99. But this garden shed at the retreat centre of Pamaloka was transformed into something of deepest significance. And inside, I won't tell you what happened, but I got a very strong sense that I was being ordained into a lineage, a living lineage, which went right back to the Buddha. And that was where my connection was really strengthened with the Buddha. I felt a definite living connection with the Buddha. He's not just a mere historical figure for me. So I would say to you, get to know the Buddha. Get to know him. Talk with people who are really inspired by the Buddha. Read some of the Pali Canon. If you are, for example, challenged by fear in your life, try and find some instances in the Pali Canon where Siddhartha or the Buddha confronted fear and see what he did. Get to know the Buddha. And then, so one takes refuge in the Buddha, but also one takes refuge in the Dharma. One has confidence that the Buddha saw what he claimed to see, and that his account of reality was profound and accurate, as expressed in the Dharma. And the vision he offers us of human existence within the Dharma attracts us more and more. It even excites us. It certainly did with me. We have confidence in Paticcasamuppada as expounded by the Buddha. We have confidence in the teachings, and that diligent practice of them can indeed lead us to something towards the insights which the Buddha experienced. We have confidence in the Noble Eightfold Path as a path which can lead to change. We have confidence in the threefold way, the six perfections, the four noble truths, whatever. Whatever a particular Dharma teaching really does it for you. We have confidence in meditation, as expressed in the Dharma, as a way of directly working the mind. We have confidence in ethical practice, and so on and so forth. So by taking refuge in the Dharma, it means having confidence that the Dharma actually works, that practicing the Dharma actually works. And then one takes refuge in the Sangha. If the Dharma is about change, then we need help in that change. Most of us cannot tread the spiritual path alone. We need encouragement. Sometimes we need a good ticking off. Any of you who have tried to change, some really radical, some habits which are really deeply rooted in us, like if you've ever smoked, giving up smoking can require a lot of support. Traditionally speaking, the Sangha is primarily composed of those who are spiritually more advanced than we are, the great bodhisattvas, the arahants, and the stream entrants, and so on and so forth. The Buddhist tradition is full of some really quite amazing figures. Together, these bodhisattvas, arahants, and stream entrants form the Arya Sangha, or the spiritual community in its highest sense. Secondarily, the Sangha is the community of all Buddhists, of us, of those who go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in some way. In the case of the Arya Sangha, in going for refuge to this Sangha means opening ourselves up to the influence of those who are a wider, who have a deeper and greater experience than ourselves. It consists in learning from them, being inspired by them, even reverencing them. In the case of the Sangha in the more ordinary sense, that's me and you, it means enjoying spiritual fellowship with one another and helping one another on the path. Sometimes you may not need a highly advanced bodhisattva to help you. All you need is an ordinary human being who is a little more developed perhaps spiritually than you are, or even just is a bit more sensible than you are. And only too often I find sometimes at beginners classes people are looking for this great guru who is so spiritually advanced. But what, if I met them, what would you do with them? What would I do with them? Sometimes what we need is just a helping hand from where we are now. And this is, we get this helping hand from each of us, from the kind of ordinary sangha, if you like. So going for refuge is not a static process. Going for refuge, finding trust and confidence in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, is not static, it's a dynamic process. Taking refuge, and it's one that gradually deepens. The Buddha spoke of his progress along the spiritual path as like a gently sloping ocean floor away from the shore. It just, there's a gradual slope to the ocean floor as it leaves the shore. And the Buddha said, this is how progress is made in my spiritual teachings. It's gradual for most of us. And I think this is reflected in the way that the kind of the movement is structured in helping us to gradually deepen our going for refuge. We have friends, we have mitras, we have order members, we have dharmacharis and dharmacharinis. So as a friend, you might be drawn to some aspects of Buddhism. And you begin to take some tentative steps towards the exploration of the Buddha and his Dharma. You might come along to introductory classes at a centre like this. You might go and listen to a visiting teacher from Tibet. You might explore Buddhism via the internet. Your interest might grow into something stronger, into some kind of heart connection that you wish to pursue further. So you might become a mitra. Becoming a mitra, you declare that you are a Buddhist, that you will meditate regularly and practice the five precepts, including vegetarianism. You make a declaration that you will help out at the centre whenever you can, and to make some contact with order members. And as a mitra, I mean there's plenty of them in this room, plenty of mitras in this room, you might find yourself becoming increasingly involved with the movement and increasingly attracted to the beauty of the Buddhist spiritual ideal. You may find that your experience of meditation is becoming deeper. Your communication with other people is expanding. And that you feel happier and less burdened by psychological conditioning. Eventually, you might find that your centre of gravity is kind of really orientating towards taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. When that point is reached, you start thinking perhaps of joining the order, of becoming a member of the Western Buddhist order. Or put more traditionally, in terms of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And if the order members who are obviously ordained are convinced that your aspiration is genuine, you are ordained into the Western Buddhist order in a beautiful ordination ceremony. And I would say my ordination ceremony is the most beautiful occurrence in my life. And in this ordination ceremony, you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You express your desire to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha with body, speech and mind. And you take the 10 precepts which are about, you know, purifying the body, speech and mind. But of course, going for refuge, this idea of going for refuge is not new. It goes right back to the Buddha. There are many, many stories in the Pali Canon of people being deeply moved by the Buddha. Something has been revealed to them, something new, something fresh, something so exciting and so wonderful that they just say, Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dharmang Saranangacchami, Sanghang Saranangacchami. To the Buddha for refuge I go. To the Dharma for refuge I go. To the Sangha for refuge I go. So I would really recommend you go into the Pali Canon and you kind of again root out stories of people who meet the Buddha, and they're so moved by what he reveals to them, by his teachings, that they exclaim in different ways. It's like carrying a lamp into darkness so that they have eyes that will see, and so forth. These wonderfully poetic but very powerful expressions of gratitude to the Buddha. So we can now see not only where the going for refuge has its origins in terms of the Buddhist tradition, but I think what I've pointed out is something of its tremendous spiritual significance. That going for refuge represents your positive emotional response, in fact your total response in a way, to the spiritual ideal. When that ideal is revealed to you, to your spiritual vision, if you like. So you may have walked when you first walked into this room, looking at the Buddha, the image of the Buddha, you felt some kind of communication. But such is its appeal that you cannot but just give yourself up to it in a certain way. As Tennyson says, we needs must love the highest when we see it. In other words, in a way we haven't got much choice. When we see something which really stirs us, then we might be very strongly drawn towards it. Now I just want to say something about the placing of the going for refuge section within the Sevenfold Puja. Because as I said earlier in the talk, I believe that the going for refuge section is right at the heart of the puja. And immediately after chanting the refuges, to the Buddha for Dharma for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, and you do it three times, body, speech and mind. What do? You chant the precepts. We recite the precepts immediately after reciting the refuges. And I think we recite the precepts because they are one of the most practical ways of practicing the Dharma. Practical and important ways actually of practicing the Dharma in our everyday lives. It's not enough to say, yes, I take refuge in the Buddha, yes, I take refuge in the Dharma and the Sangha, and Dharma, yes, I take refuge in the Sangha. If we feel this sincerely enough, we will want to act upon it. And one way of acting upon this heartfelt connection or stirrings presented to us by the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha is to practice the precepts. Now we're all capable of practicing precepts. We are all capable. Every single person in this room can practice the ethics without exception. But we have to want to practice ethics in the Buddhist tradition. We have to have a conviction that the Buddha was right when he said, if you act in this way, happiness will follow for you and others. If you act in this way, unhappiness will follow for you and for others. It's the classic opening two verses of the Dhammapada. We have to have a kind of conviction that it's worth trying to practice ethics. It's worth trying to develop skillful states of mind and try and move away from the proliferation of unskillful states of mind within our own minds for the benefit of ourselves and for the benefit of others. And we have to have a kind of a conviction that yes, our actions do have consequences for ourselves and for others. And to the extent that we hold this conviction will determine how carefully we practice ethics in our everyday lives. Of course we don't kill. But there are many, many ways of not practicing the first precept. And they get subtler and subtler and subtler and subtler. And one thing I've learned over the years of practice is that the practice of the ethics, practice of ethical life, keeps going. It keeps going and going and going and going as we open up to the Dharma. Similarly, our practice of meditation. I think it's really important that we have a conviction that it's actually worth doing. It's actually worth meditating, because it will make a difference. Not necessarily after meditation A, but in the future. You know, the slow but cumulative effects of meditation will build. And I think we've got to have some confidence in that. And the word for this kind of trust and confidence in the Buddhist tradition is Shraddha. And it can be translated as placing one's heart upon. So one has a growing confidence and trust that practicing the Buddhist teachings really does make a difference for ourselves and for others. They really do work. And Shraddha is the fuel, if you like, that supports our efforts in our practice. It actually moves us along the spiritual path. And it's actually Shraddha, I think, that makes going for refuge possible. Because without Shraddha, then going for refuge is not possible. Because when we start to experience Shraddha, we are drawn towards the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. But faith has to be worked upon. In the years of practice, Shraddha has gradually grown in strength and breadth. And I think the development of Shraddha is very important, especially in the early stages of the early years of exploring Buddhism. So in the Sevenfold Puja, the refuges and precepts section is preceded by the worship section, which is there to help us connect with this response of Shraddha to the Buddha Dharma. It's there to prepare us for really taking on board the refuges and precepts section. So in the worship section, we try and make a heartfelt connection with the Buddha in whatever way works for us, and a heartfelt connection that inspires us. After chanting the refuges and precepts, what happens next? Well, we want to confess. We've said we really want to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We've chanted the precepts, and we realise actually that those precepts, I'm working on them, but I've got a load of stuff which I've breached the precepts. What do I do with that? Well, I confess it. So, in the puja, you've got the refuges and precepts, and then you've got confession of faults. And right at the end, you've got that beautiful, beautiful transference of merit section. I mean, the beauty of that section still kind of really stuns me. You know, for the words and the poetry, but also what it's trying to express, is quite phenomenal. It's not about just us. It's about us in relationship to the whole universe. One reason why we go for refuge, because we as individuals can make a big impact upon this universe. And don't forget that. Don't forget that. You're not doing this just for yourselves. You're not in this alone. We're all trying to work towards something together. So just before I close, a few words about development of Shraddha. If it's so important, how do we develop it? Well, we can develop Shraddha through meditation. Particularly as we start to experience more absorption in meditation, we can get a glimpse, maybe, or a sense, or a whiff of what the Buddha was trying to get at when he said that all things are conditioned. We get a sense of the enormous potential the mind has for positive emotion, for forgiveness, for joy, and so forth, as experienced in the Metta Bhavana. We get a sense of this, that we are connected to other people quite fundamentally. My suffering is your suffering is my suffering, and so on. Your joys are similar to my joys, and so forth. So the Metta Bhavana, in my experience, can open up a beautiful vista of realising that I'm not alone. We can develop faith through puja and ritual. Puja and ritual, of course, speak to our non-rational minds, to our imagination. It's only in the worship section, imagine what it's like having the Buddha in front of you. Imagine the Buddha, you know, communicating with people and really, you know, impacting people's lives. Use your imagination in puja. Otherwise the puja is dead. It's dull, I think. So, and doing puja puts us into contact with very important spiritual moods like worship, shraddha, and so forth. And even if we sit there doing puja and we think, oh, I just really don't want to do this, you do it a bit begrudgingly, sometimes the fact that you do it most, more often than not, with other people can really just draw you along until by the end of the puja you think, that was great. That was really great. Wow. And who, as I say, cannot be moved by the exquisite sentiments of transference of merit? We can develop faith through visionary experiences. I'm not being funny here, but sometimes in meditation, things happen. And I mean, I remember going on my first retreat down at Vajraloka, and suddenly the Buddha appeared in front of me, and it was really happening. And but then he appeared to me again, and then again. So in the space of a week, things were happening in my meditation, which really sowed the seeds of Shraddha and really sowed my connection with the Buddha. So if they happen, don't, you know, take them seriously, think about them. And sometimes people ask, why is my email bluecorn@mail.com? It's bluecorn. I'm not going to say exactly why, but it reminds me of the visions I had of the Buddha on this retreat at Vajraloka. We can develop faith through the appreciation of art and beauty. Take yourself off into the countryside and, you know, or go and sit by a river and watch the beautiful grace of swans gliding across the surface of the water on a balmy summer afternoon. Come to the centre. You know, the beauty of the shrinery is 10 times more than the beauty of my shrine at home. We can develop faith through study. And there's plenty of opportunities for study here at the centre. I've already mentioned getting to know the Buddha by dipping into the Pali Canon. But through study we can experience, we can contact our response to truth. So when the Buddha says, if you act in this way, happiness will follow. If we act in this way, unhappiness will follow. What is your response? Is it, no, I'm not sure if I believe that, or not? Study engages the rational mind with the conceptual expressions of the Buddha's teaching. It plants seeds, which we go away and we mull over, we think about, we kind of try and get them to drop a bit deeper. So we can develop faith through study. We can develop faith through going on retreats, day retreats, weekend retreats, longer retreats, where we can just step outside of our normal lives and just allow a bit more space of meditation to happen in and so forth. And finally, we can develop faith through friendship. And I think this is this has been a very, very important source of faith in my life. When I was Mitra Convener for many in Manchester, I experienced time and time again many men just grappling with the Dharma, really trying to work it out, is this really for them or not, working with their doubts, but conversely working with their inspiration and working with that tension between doubt and inspiration. And what made the difference was somebody stepping in and saying, are you okay? Do you want to talk about anything? So friendship is a very, very important part of practice, and one that can give immeasurable support. And because it's had such a crucially important role to play in my own life, in my own spiritual life, I'm very keen to kind of give back what I received. So I want to conclude now. I've been talking for 50 minutes and it's time to wrap up. As I say, there's so much more I could have said about this topic of going for refuge. But what I've tried to communicate to you is what does it mean, and also why bother going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And it's partly been a personal account, but maybe you've made one or two connections yourself with, you know, the importance of going for refuge. And as we go for refuge, the one thing which I love about going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, it's non-ending. It just carries on and on and on. And I love that. It's like, oh, okay, you think, well, I've cracked the five precepts now. But then something else opens up, and then something else. There's always something to work on. And I think this is one of the great beauties of the spiritual life and deepening kind of exploration of it. So good luck. Good luck with your own practice. And I hope you can take something away from this talk to go and think about for yourselves. And just really deepen your exploration of the Buddha, the Dharma, in the context of Sangha. Thank you.